Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Please call the next case.
Happ versus Commonwealth, Charles E. Hayden, Appellant's Counsel, Elizabeth K. Fitzgerald, Assistant Attorney General, Appellee's Counsel.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Charles Hayden and I represent the appellant Shaquise Cappy. I would like to reserve 5 minutes if I may. In this case, there was a misapplication of the Bowman versus Commonwealth case, the holding in that case that was acknowledged by the Court of Appeals. However, the Court of Appeals ultimately concluded that that was harmless error. Under Bowman versus Commonwealth.
Counsel, I would like you to help me with a threshold question. You prevailed in the Court of Appeals on the merits of the issue, and then the Court of Appeals held that any error was harmless. You assigned error to that. Looking at your brief, I don't see any standard of review for harmless error, whether constitutional or non-constitutional, what the standard of review is, and then an argument for why the Court of Appeals was wrong to conclude it was harmless. In other words, laying out the evidence that was presented, why the excluded evidence was significant and undermines confidence in the verdict. And under our precedent, if you don't do that, if you don't brief it, you don't have a standard of review, we can't reach the merits of it. Help me with that threshold point.
Well, certainly the standard of review that's involved evidentiary issues, presenting a question of law that are reviewed de novo on.
There is a distinct line of cases that parses if an error is alleged to be harmless, is it constitutional or non-constitutional? So there's a standard of review there. And then beyond that, we expect to see argument presented, maybe case law analogy, et cetera, for how the Court of Appeals was wrong to conclude something was harmless. And I'm just not seeing that in the brief.
Well, I would respectfully submit that I do not cite what the standard of review is. And I would
on harmless error? Can you show me where that is in the brief? What page?
Well, where we had the standard of review, it deals with evidentiary issues. Now, I noted in my argument that the relevant evidence that has a tendency to add force and effect to a party's defense is admissible.
Right. Now, I understand that.
And that this well, was a case.
You won on the evidence point in the Court of Appeals. You lost on harmless error. So the key thing is, why was the Court of Appeals wrong to conclude it was harmless? And I just don't see what I would expect to see, which is
I certainly argued that the error that the Court of Appeals erred in ruling that the error, the acknowledged error, they erred in ruling that that was harmless error.
Right, you assigned error.
The central issue in the case is the help that this what the central issue is this the person depicted in the videos or not?
Mr. Hayden, to follow up on Justice McCullough's question, I looked other than the heading based on your assignments of error. I don't believe the word harmless appears in the argument section of your brief. It appears to me, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that you took the merits argument on whether it was error from your Court of Appeals brief and just repeated it verbatim with no additions regarding harmless error in the argument section of this brief. Is that what happened?
Well, that it is largely true that I don't want to be accused of making a different argument to the Supreme Court than the argument I made to the Court of Appeals. So I'm raising substantially the same issue.
And I understand that as you're making the trying to make the point that it was error, that they were correct to find it was error. But by definition, if that's what you did, you can't possibly have addressed the Court of Appeals determination that it was harmless error, because that wasn't a part of your brief in the Court of Appeals. It's a new thing. It requires some additional argument, doesn't it?
I respectfully submit, when I present the same argument that I made in the Court of Appeals, and I argue that the Court of Appeals erred in its ruling and that it was harmless error, I have preserved the issue. I'm presenting the same issue to this court that's reviewed.
Other than the heading, that the assignment of error, where is there any argument under Rule 520 in your brief that it was harmful error? Where do you say that? Where do you say the jury would have reached a different conclusion?
I note that this was a situation where this was relevant evidence that tended to add force and effect to a party's defense. That's admissible. That where a trial court errs in preventing the defense from presenting relevant evidence, adding force and effect to Cappy's defense, namely that it's simply not the person, Cappy's not the person depicted in the video, the conviction should be set aside at that point. The issue is, I certainly argued that the Court of Appeals erred in concluding it was harmless there. The fact of the matter is the substantial evidence cited by the Commonwealth in their brief, it was simply circumstantial cell phone evidence that says, well, he's in the vicinity, was heading towards the place, and then there were some afterwards there was he received a message and there was this fire bullet remnant that was found in the car owned by Cappy. But those are all circumstantial facts that are consistent with, for example, that he's someone who has been an accessory after the fact, for example, but did not participate in the murders. The central issue here was he the person who was depicted in the video? And the Court of Appeals ruled and erred in ruling that Ms. Kirkendall's testimony would that exclusion of her testimony would have had no effect on the jury.
Mr. Hayden, this is Justice Kelsey.
Yes.
The Court of Appeals made two different rulings, right? The first ruling was that the trial court erred in not permitting this testimony. The second ruling, completely different ruling, was doesn't matter, which rendered the first ruling dicta. You did not appeal the second ruling. You did not make a single argument on brief that the error that was found was harmful under the proper legal standard.
Well, I would respectfully disagree. I think that we're clearly, I'm arguing that this is evidence that should have come in and that it had an impact that on the jury, the failure, the absence of being able to hear this testimony by those who
knew. Mr. Hayden, can you point to anywhere in the brief where you use the word harmless in some place other than a heading, arguing that it was error to find this harmless? So not the assignment.
No, I can't. But I respectfully submit when I argue in the assignment of error that the Court of Appeals erred in ruling that it's harmless error, that preserves the issue. I point out what they got it wrong on was ruling harmless error.
The question isn't whether you've preserved the issue. I agree you preserved the issue at the assignment of error stage. The question is then, did you present with the court any argument to agree with that position? And it seems to me you just conceded that you have not, Because there is no place in the argument section of your brief other than the heading where you even use the word harmless once.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's correct, but I thought that preserves the issue. I would respectfully note that as the testimony by those who knew the defendant over a period of time and in a variety of circumstances offers to the jury a perspective it could not acquire in its limited exposure to the jury. A lay witness may give an opinion concerning the identity of a person depicted in a surveillance video if there's some basis for concluding the witness is more likely to correctly identify the defendant from the photograph than the jury. And certainly in this case, the quality of the image being reviewed is a factor in the usefulness analysis, and the blurry images, a non-direct camera angle, and partially obscured facial features are certainly factors which suggest that the jury would benefit from lay opinion assisting in the identification. And so we had these circumstances. I've noted that it wasn't harmless error, and I've pointed out that it's for these reasons that the limited exposure of a jury compared to this lady's very detailed and explanation of why this person in the video is not, in fact, the defendant, they would have benefited from that. We can't say that the exclusion of that testimony would have had no impact on the jurors' interpretation or analysis of the evidence in this case. It likely would have had an impact if they'd had the benefit of hearing why she didn't feel this was the person. Her opinion could have aided the jury's analysis. She should have been permitted to testify based on her lengthy knowledge of the defendant's appearance. The absence of her testimony did influence the outcome of the trial. And this was an error in excluding the testimony that was, I would submit, significant. I certainly felt that pointing out, making the assignment of error, that this is not harmless error, and then proceed to point out what the testimony of Ms. Kirkendall was. It went into a detailed review of that, and it explains in substance what it is that her testimony would have provided to a jury. That is sufficient, I would submit, to preserve the issue. I substantially reiterated the argument I made in the Court of Appeals because it's the same issue. It's reviewed de novo by this court, just as it was reviewed de novo by the Court of Appeals. As I noted, the evidentiary issues presenting a question of law are reviewed de novo by this court. And that was noted in the Court of Appeals decision. And certainly a trial court, by definition, abuses its discretion when it makes an error of a law, which absolutely happened in this case. They misapplied the Bowman case. The Commonwealth moved to exclude the testimony of Ms. Kirkendall. The Commonwealth contended that Bowman's holding did not apply to non-identifications, and the trial court agreed with the Commonwealth that Bowman applied only to lay opinion testimony identifying a defendant, but not to the converse, which involves a different analysis. I argued that was wrong, and proceeded to give a detailed description of how Ms. Kirkendall's testimony would have aided the jury in analyzing that video, which was the key evidence. So I think it's all I can say on the subject, but I would respectfully submit that the issue is preserved and ought to be considered by this court.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Commonwealth?
Good morning. May it please the court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. I'd like to address the procedural argument mentioned by the court. Rule 527D does require a brief to contain argument and authorities relating to each assignment of error. This court has recently recognized in Durham in the 525 context, the court has discretion to invoke its own procedural rules, even where a litigant has not. If the court finds the defendant's argument is not adequately developed, then the defendant's second assignment of error in this regard may be dismissed pursuant to Rule 527.
Well, is it adequately developed?
No, Your Honor. I would submit in reviewing the briefs in preparation for argument today, the court's points are well taken.
If the Court of Appeals said something is harmless, which is required by statute to look at, that we would first be told, is this constitutional or non-constitutional harmless error? So we know the prism through which to review the issue. And then second, that counsel would marshal factual points about the strength of the Commonwealth's case relative to the excluded evidence, what difference would that have made, and possibly analogies from case law saying something was harmless and is distinguishable or not or whatever. We don't have any of that.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that is a violation of the rule, a clear violation of the rule, as the court has noted.
Ms. Fitzgerald, this is Jess Kelsey. One of the going forward possibilities that I'd like to brainstorm with you is the actual decision on error. The Court of Appeals pointed out that this was a pretty new issue for our courts, not necessarily something of first impression in a clear sense, but a very new issue. It was not specifically addressed by the trial court and went on for 8 pages, citing dozens of cases, mostly out-of-state cases, on the subject of lay witness identification. Your argument on brief is in part that the trial court was not simply making a Bowman error, if it was any error at all, but was also clearly stating that, in the trial court's opinion, it was an unreliable platform for this argument. Therefore, abuse of discretion is the proper standard. So that's background, that you don't need to say yes or no on that. But all that being true, it took 3 paragraphs for the Court of Appeals to conclude that this is harmless as a matter of law. Doesn't that render the 8 pages of analysis on a new issue dicta?
Your Honor, because it was not necessary to the court's ultimate ruling, I guess I would agree with the court that it is dicta. However, it was necessary for the court, before the court reached the issue of harmless error, to find there was error to begin with. I think I'm uncomfortable saying that the court's affirmative ruling that the trial court erred was dicta. This is not a case where we have an assuming without deciding type language.
But if you had if you had had exactly this opinion issued by the Court of Appeals, and the defendant, for whatever reason, goes, well, I can't win the harmless error point, so I'll just give up, and doesn't file an appeal, you would not be allowed, as the Attorney General, to file an appeal of an 8-page novel issue on law. It would end with the Court of Appeals. It would be completely unreviewable by you.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's what renders it dicta. If a ruling is immunized by the intermediate court from further appellate review by the nature of the ruling, that is the key factor that renders it dicta. It's not the court's decision to go beyond what needed to be done under best and narrowest.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. I take the court's point, and I do agree that for that reason, because of the procedural posture, I would agree that it is dicta then.
And Ms. Fitzgerald, you've raised it lacks the assuming without deciding language. Could the exact merits result here have been achieved if you take out the 8 pages that Justice Kelsey has discussed and just put assuming without deciding it's error, and then have the three paragraphs saying it's harmless beyond any question. And therefore we
approve. Sure. Yes, and, Your Honor.
And that way the Commonwealth is not allegedly bound by an opinion that's going to be cited as precedential in hundreds of cases going forward, dozens of courts, and every prosecutor and every lower court judge and every court of appeals panel will, according to some, be allegedly bound by.
That, yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And the Commonwealth's position, of course, Your Honor, is also that that intermediary holding by the appellate, by the Court of Appeals, whether it was necessary to the ultimate result, was also error, or as this court likes to say, that it could be affirmed as the right result for a different reason, because
Don't you see the symmetry of this? If we were to conclude that it's harmless, or we would conclude that the harmless error argument had been waived, we'd be violating our own, we'd be speaking through both sides of our mouth to issue another 8-page opinion, either going in either direction on the merits point, because we don't need to say anything more.
Anything more than the procedural default, Your Honor?
Right.
That is correct. However, this court does have the prerogative to dismiss on the best and narrowest grounds, and in an issue where I don't believe this is an issue of first impression. I believe that this court's case law in Bowman, or excuse me, in Jones, Court of Appeals case law in Bowman, and our own rule of evidence, Rule 2701, cover this area. But this court does have the prerogative to determine what it feels are the best and narrowest grounds. The narrowest ground, I think, of course, would be the procedural default, but that doesn't necessarily make it the best ground when, as you say, we do have this ruling from the Court of Appeals, which will remain when that ruling is affirmed by this court ultimately. Well, and so it may be...
Ms. Fitzgerald, is there anything that would prevent us from concluding that the harmless error ruling has been waived for the violation of Rule 527, but still vacating the entirety of the Court of Appeals opinion? Because, of course, right now it is vacated pending our resolution of the case. Would anything...
No, Your Honor, there's nothing that would prevent the court from applying 527 and dismissing the second assignment of error for failure to provide adequate briefing to the court.
And then could we vacate the remainder of the Court of Appeals opinion on the issue of whether it was error or not, and therefore just reduce it to a nullity? Do we have the authority to do that? We do, don't we?
Yes, Your Honor, of course.
May I ask a curiosity question, Ms. Fitzgerald? Did the Commonwealth in its brief argue 527?
No, Your Honor.
And so were you reading, and this may be an unfair question, but were you reading Mr. Hayden's brief to incorporate his entire opening arguments with regard to why this was an incorrect ruling to not allow the testimony to be somehow incorporated in his harmless error assignment of error? If that makes sense. I'm just wondering, curiosity question.
Sure, Your Honor, and I don't have a good reason for the court as to why that default issue was not briefed in this matter. And as I've noted, it's the court's rule, and especially under the rationale in Durham, the court can invoke it. However, I think the best evidence, would be that sufficiency assignment of error and would be that affirmative argument. However, as the court has noted, harmless error is its own separate body of law. There's a separate standard of review, as Justice McCullough noted. We have the constitutional versus non-constitutional standard. And then again, we have that substantial influence inquiry, which is fully lacking from the brief.
And by definition, the sufficiency analysis would require us to consider the record without the testimony, much as if it's evidence that shouldn't have been admitted, we consider the record as the record on the sufficiency analysis. That
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And so for that reason, I would not say, and it's not our position, that a sufficiency briefing could adequately preserve a separate harmless error argument because of the reason the court was just mentioned, and because, as Justice McCullough noted, there is a separate standard review and a separate body of law there. And that's notwithstanding that the court has, in these cases, is statutorily obligated to do a harmless error review in every case. We do have the proper assignment of error here, but we do not have that argument authorities that would match up with the harmless error assignment of error can on briefing. And I apologize to the court for the oversight.
Can I just take you on a bit of a different tact, more of a substantive tact, assuming that we don't dispose of the appeal along the lines that has been previously discussed. A very, very interesting thing happened in this trial, and that is at some point the Commonwealth showed the grainy image, the still from the security camera to the jury. And at that time, defense counsel actually had the defendant, Mr. Caffey, stand up. In essence, letting the jury say, look at this picture, look at this guy, it doesn't add up. Practically speaking, what would be the difference between having the family friend testify to the same thing, and secondarily, by the Commonwealth not objecting, has the Commonwealth kind of waived that issue? In terms of whether or not somebody else could make that comparison, because after all, the jury was asked to make the comparison, and the family friend certainly knows Caffey better than the jury.
Well, Your Honor, identity is an issue of fact, and criminal agency is an issue for the fact finder in nearly every criminal case. I would submit that Caffey, by placing himself in front of the jury, in front of counsel table, turning to the side, turning to the front, and inviting them to find as a factual matter that he was not the man in the video, when the jury rejected that factual hypothesis of innocence, made the fact finding that, in fact, he was the man in the video, which they were competent to do by virtue of their role.
That evidence could have been strengthened, though, if the family friend had been allowed to testify basically to the same thing. So the defendant does it non-verbally by simply standing up. The proposed witness then backs that up by actually saying verbally, no, that's just not the same person. Just from, if we do consider the case, would that not be strong evidence for the jury to consider?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. And that's in part because, as we've argued on brief, that testimony by this particular witness, by Ms. Kirkendall, didn't meet the foundation requirements under 2701, given her lack of familiarity at the relevant time on April as opposed to in January, and also her testimony that was proffered indicated
then the jury shouldn't have been able to do it either, because they certainly didn't know what he looked like at the time of the alleged offense. And again,
respectfully, Your Honor, I believe that we are talking about apples and oranges here, because on the one hand, we're talking about foundation for a lay witness to offer an opinion, to opine as to who is the person in there. And on the other hand, we're talking about the province of the fact finder, the jury, to determine as a factual matter the truth of who is in that photograph. So the foundational requirement to offer an opinion on that versus the jury's role as fact finder to actually answer that question, I mean, I think in a different place. This court has long held that a jury is competent to draw those conclusions using their common sense and everyday experience. And if the court's point is why can't...
I was just going to say that answer is very helpful. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. And to the court's point further, even if this testimony should have been admitted in this case, the Court of Appeals correctly found that any error here was harmless, both because of the character of the particular testimony that was offered. We have a family friend who's known the defendant since birth saying that he was essentially not, in fact, a cold-blooded killer who shot this man 14 times in a parking lot complex and then stood over him and fired additional rounds. That testimony comes with inherent bias. We further have her saying that she didn't know exactly what he looked like at the time of the crime. His hairstyle had changed. And then we also have her agreeing that the picture, that she couldn't make him out based on that rendering. So we have a somewhat weak identification from her. And as this court has noted, the analysis for non-constitutional harmless error involves determining whether the exclusion of this testimony would have substantially influenced the fact finder. And here the Court of Appeals correctly concluded that the other evidence in this case, I believe the term they used was abundant. In addition to the jury's own ability, as we've just discussed, to view Shakiz Cappy as he stood in front of them and compare him to that video and the still video, we also have significant circumstantial evidence, including the fact that his car was the vehicle that brought all of the shooters to the parking lot complex. A shell casing from the murder weapon was also found in that vehicle. We have him in communication with the relevant players beforehand and moving towards the crime scene along with Tesso Blizzard just before this crime occurred. And finally, we have those series of incriminating text messages immediately afterwards. Check 10, get low, get rid of everything, it's gone.
Ms. Fitzgerald, if we get to that analysis, don't you have a fairly significant problem with respect to the fact that someone is calling his phone at a time when arguably both people would have been present in the same vehicle, and then about 5 minutes later or 5 seconds later, someone else, the same number, is calling the phone at the time when they would have all been canvassing the neighborhood together? So it isn't that gap in time with regard to those two facts a fairly significant problem with the case?
If Mr. Chief Justice, if I could respond to the court's question.
Yes, you may.
Thank you. Your Honor, a close reading of the timestamps of the record indicate that when Mr. Pemberton called Cappy, which is the argument that counsel is making on brief, this is at appendix page 661, Pemberton calls Cappy at 1127. But if you observe the video, Commonwealth Exhibit 6, and this is also mentioned at appendix page 495, it's at 1125 that we start seeing people exit the video. So the Commonwealth's position at trial was that Pemberton, DeJour Pemberton, was the getaway driver. So at 1125, Cappy leaves the vehicle. At 1127, Pemberton calls Cappy. It's perfectly consistent with the Commonwealth's theory of the case for Pemberton, the driver of that vehicle, to be calling Cappy, who was no longer with him and out of the car at that time.
At 5 seconds before that, at 1122, I think, all four of the people are still in the car. So if Pemberton is the driver, as you offer, the driver's in the car with Cappy.
Yes, Your Honor. So the court's referring to the call from Tesso Blizzard at 1122,
so that's,
I believe,
Blizzard.
Which is some, yes, ma'am, which is something that has not been argued by the defendant in this case, but I would submit that that single piece of evidence which supports the defendant's hypothesis of innocence, of course, this court is looking at the great weight of the other evidence in this case. People call each other when they're together all the time. It could be a pocket dial. We know that Blizzard called Cappy multiple times while they were together that evening. It could have just been the last phone call. That does not defeat the harmless error analysis here, considering the great weight of the other evidence, the jury's own identification of Cappy as he sat in front of them, and particularly those incriminating text messages that were sent within 30 minutes of the shooter's likenesses being released to local news stations. For any and all of the reasons that we've discussed this afternoon, I'd ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
All right. Any rebuttal, Mr. Hayden?
No, Your Honor. I have no additional comments. Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much. This session of the Supreme Court of Virginia is adjourned.